Session number 1860, Rule 2.
Reverend Stephen, Rule 2.
They got their own bake oven by not giving me the rank that an ACG should have. I remained as a lieutenant colonel. We were training. Headquarters were at Largs, the ANQ department. The G department was down in London. And so I had quite a lot of travelling, which I did by train at night, down to the advanced headquarters, and then with my own headquarters in Scotland. We trained as to expect an opposed landing, and we used to do this on the Malakin Tower, and we hadn't got any proper landing craft. We just got some sort of barges which went down with us, the Cardiff, which carried the officers of the headquarters, and Fred Turner, who was a guardsman, commandant, used to have all his clerks standing on the edge of the ship and watching the other one as it rose and fell with the tide. Used to try and get it so that when the both lot were level, he then said in a loud guardsman's voice, "Jump!" And all these clerks jumped into the air and fell in the ship, the landing craft. Until one time when he said jump, the two craft yawned. And there were all these clerks in midair. And the look on their faces was the funniest sight I think I saw in the war. The whole lot of them went slap into the drink, and it wasn't very warm, it was winter time. Then I tried to get a naval officer who was with us, who was doing the spotting for the guns. And I wanted him to put a shell into a lock, which got some very good trout in it. But I couldn't persuade him, he wouldn't have it at any price. I thought it was a cheap way of getting a few trout ready for tomorrow's breakfast. No. Much too serious a sailor for that. And actually, when the landing in Algiers came, it was rather like going out on a holiday cruise party. I went out and I travelled round with the chief paymaster, sitting on just over £1 million in gold in the jeep. We were delivering it to the banks against our own currency, which we'd brought with us in saving notes. It's the only time I sat on so much money.
So you were actually in the North Africa landing Operation Torch yourself,
were
you?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what you recollect about that in detail?
We went ashore to Algiers, went tied up at the dockside.
When you say we, who was that?
First Army Headquarters, plus a good number of other troops and whatnot, because we were in one of the Empress ships, which is a fair size. And we were taken up to Maison Carré, which was the agricultural school just outside Algiers. We weren't there very long. We moved up to Constantine. There I had an experience. General Anderson was invited to go shooting partridges in the hills at some old sheikh's place, and he nominated me to go for him in his place. And so I found an Arab sitting outside my billet. And he said, I will be here tomorrow morning at 6:30, and we will leave for the Sheikh's house up in the mountains. And he'd sat there all night, because I was a guest of the Sheikh. Got to this way out camp up in the Atlas Mountains and had breakfast. Couscous. And then came this shooting party, which consisted of the French resident in Africa, a French officer, and myself. And as I was representing General Anderson, I was given, I suppose, the best horse. I got my foot in the stirrup, swung myself up, missed the old animal altogether. He just bucked high into the air, and I sat down in front of all these laughing, genuine Bedouin Arabs on my backside, having fallen off the house. But the whole thing was very sharp-footed, and we went on these funny trails in the, on the mountain sides, and these wretched chukor, I suppose you'd call them, sort of partridge, would run along in front and then fly. And I wasn't going to trust myself to let him fly at two partridges, which if I hit them, fell some thousand feet down the valley, whether I'd follow it with the horse. So I didn't shoot at all. I just was content to keep myself on board. I went back and we had a huge banquet. And then I was taken back to Constantine, where my headquarters were for that time. And then we moved up again, just short of Guadima.
Just short of where?
Guadima, Beda, it was the name of the village at the bottom of the pass. And Guadima was a little, just a few houses where we'd temporarily set up headquarters. And it was there that I began to think a bit about the chaplains. None of them had had a shot fired. And they've been really put into the juice of a situation with this mountain warfare, which isn't funny at the best of times. And I thought, well, the only thing that I can do to make them feel a bit better is to get Jack Benoit, who was our AQ, to requisition a little pub on the main road, which I would turn into a sort of rest camp, where they get a hot bath, complete change of clothing. I arranged all that with the old people. And then back to the battalion. So it worked very well, and I think I had quite a few going a bit daft. They got a bit of normal treatment. And then we moved right up. The Sucre Chemis, where the Mad Mile ran dead straight, and the Boche used to delight in shooting up any car that went down this straight road. And so you always had to travel with the roof back and somebody standing up so that he could shout. And then whoever was driving it just drove the car into the sand, and we were sort of bolted to the nearest bit of cover, and Messerschmitt went over firing all guns. I had that about four times, and only once did he damage the car.
Did you say it was called the Mad Mile?
Mad Mile. Mm.
And where was it?
It was in the Majerda Valley, from Sucre Chemis to Beja. It's a long straight road. It was there that I got into trouble with old Adams, the general. Because one of the things which I found the troops lacked was news, you know, reliable news. Things like whether Arsenal won or not, you know, that sort of thing. And so I used to listen to a French fellow's radio and then get my clerks to type out a little bit of a paper on the foolscap, usually it's a couple of sheets, with all the local news which I got. And that increased considerably from about 5,000 when it first started to over 20 when I've been going for just over a week with my little paper. And we published in it that we'd found a flat stone with a very peculiar inscription on it, and that we'd got the local professor from antiquities from Algiers University to translate it for us, and we would give the answer tomorrow, as he would say. And we put down that never in the field of human endeavor had so few been commanded by so many. We had actually one brigade in action, and behind that were brigade headquarters, divisional headquarters, corps headquarters, army headquarters, and a few days before, Ike's raid in Algiers. All behind one brigade who were in action. I was hauled up in front of old Adam. He really tore a strip off me for being disrespectful to higher command. After all, so it's true. He said, I know it's true, but that doesn't count.
Were you suitably chastened?
I was suitably chastened, yes. I had a great regard for old Anderson.
Whilst you were with the First Army in North Africa, what did you notice about relations between the First Army troops and the Americans?
Not very good. There was that dreadful affair at Kasserine Gap, where they lost, 360 kitted-up tanks that weren't hit. They had an escape hatch underneath them, and they met the 21st Division of Rommel's. And I think they'd all been taught that war was rather like the Western Wild West. They did all the shooting and the bad fellows all fell down flat. But they didn't. So they hopped it through the escape hatch in the bottom of the tank, which of course sealed itself immediately, which flipped back and closed, and there were all these tanks with nobody in them. And it took I don't remember how many guns they had at the corner. I was up in the hills above Kasserine with General Anderson, and he was worried that if they got through the gap and got to Bern or the coast, we'd all be in the bag, and so would Africa. And guards. First Independent Brigade of Guards did the blocking of the gap, and I've forgotten which artillery. The 25-pounders were on both sides of the gap, and they smashed 21st Ben's Division, and we were free of it. And then, of course, that was almost at the very end of the campaign in Africa. Monty had come. He didn't do anything. Alexander was the general who took charge of both armies. And
Why were relations between the British and American troops?
Well, oversexed, overpaid over here.
But that was in Britain. What about in North Africa?
In North Africa, it was more or less the same. The Americans were always boasting how much more they got paid than the British army.
But the British troops knew about the American setback at the Kasserine Pass in
detail, did they? Yes. Very much so.
How did they react to that?
They were a bit angry.
Because they felt they'd been jeopardised by it.
Yeah, it's not only that, but they realised they'd have to fight the same battles all over again to regain the position that had been lost.
Did you like the Americans you came across? Or?
Some I did that were attached to our headquarters once you get to know them all right. But I can't say I was greatly enamoured of them.
But was it just because they were extremely green?
Yes, they were.
Because presumably this was the first time they'd been in action.
The first time they'd heard a shot fired in anger.
What did you and your brother officers in North Africa feel about the calibre of the German troops whom you were facing?
It's a difficult one. We had some trouble with the Hitler Youth. They had a battalion which crept through the mountains, and I think it was the 5th Brigade headquarters. These kids caught them, put them against the wall and shot the lot. Of course there was a good deal of ill feeling with the troops, and so they caught these lads, and that was that. Then you could do it quite easily in the high mountains, go through on these little tracks. And I was asked by the brigadier in charge of Rimi if I'd like to go and see a Tiger tank. He didn't tell me it was 15 miles behind the German lines. And we went in a jeep down these tracks in the high mountains, saw this perishing thing, and he wanted to work out what he would require to move it, recover it. He spotted us and let fly, and luckily missed us, and back to our headquarters.
Was there any rivalry between the First Army and the Eighth Army?
Not a great deal. They looked upon us as being what you might call correct. In other words, we wore uniform. Whereas the 8th Army was wearing scarves and coloured shirts and sand shoes and whatnot, which we rather looked down on. Didn't seem quite right. And then suddenly it was all over. We were through to Carthage, where my last headquarters were. And that was it. All the Germans and the Italians were captured and put in camps, and all that guarded them was just a strand of barbed wire. Just lopped off an area and filled it full of Bosch and Italians.
Did they try to escape?
No. No, the Germans came marching in perfect form. The Italians were standing on the roadside thumbing our traffic to get a lift to the camp.
Trying to get behind wire?
Yeah. They probably felt safe.
So the Germans were disciplined about being POW?
Completely, yes. They were good soldiers. It was just the SS troops that showed the trouble.
Did you have any contact with the US Army chaplains?
only met one, and he was so full of all the things that he had. He had so many sergeants under him, and various other things which we didn't have.
What kind of things did he have? Equipment?
Equipment. Well, they were very lavish with everything. That's when we started Second Army, one of the things I realized was this question of news. And I got 680 car radio sets for them out of the Americans, so they could listen to the news.
What kind, did the actual chaplain himself have more equipment than you had?
Oh yes, a good deal more.
What type of things?
Typewriters. loudspeaker outfit. We were taking services in the open. And all the rest of it.
Did he seem to be telling you all this to impress you?
I think so. I think that was the idea. How much better they were treated.
What was your reaction to what he told you?
I think general ignorance of the whole thing, as far as I was concerned. I didn't care two hoots for the theatrical side of it.
After North Africa, you then became involved in the Northwest Europe campaign,
mm-hmm.
did you?
Yeah.
Or did you go to Italy?
No, I was brought back just at the time that Italy was about to start to take over the same job with Second Army.
You mean at the time of the Sicily landings?
Yes. I arrived back in this country beginning of August 43, and instead of I had 180 chaplains in First Army, I got 680 in Second Army, most of which had never been in action or seen action. And so I talked that over with General Dempsey, or Bimbo. And he said, what are you going to do about it? I said, well, I want to borrow your defense regiment, Army Defense Regiment, to train them. So he agreed very rapidly to that. And we set up a place called Church Stowe.
Church Stowe?
Church Stowe in Northampton as a battle school. That's it.
What exactly happened there?
Well, we taught chaplains how to learn for themselves if anybody took a shot at them where it came from, which is one of the reasons so many people got hit, that the bullet would smack into the side where they were. And instead of usually taking avoiding action by putting the bank or whatever it was between them and the fella, they just crouched down, and of course the second shot was that. Finish. And so we trained them that. We trained them how to dig rapidly and what depth was needed.
So you were responsible for the setting up of Church Stowe?
Yeah, Church Stowe, school. Yes.
When was it set up?
It set up in September 43 and ran through until February or March of 44.
What was its full official title?
Second Army Chaplains Battle School.
Who was in charge of it? You yourself?
eventually, but the major who commanded the headquarter troops ran it. And his officers acted as instructors. And his troops also doing something towards teaching these lads how to learn. One of the things I'd found out very early on was that I had to break down the weekend feeling.
What was that?
Well, Saturday was always a workless day. You gave up for all the work you'd done during the week. Sunday was a day of rest, so-called. And then Monday you started again on the racket. Well, most of the big movements, both German and our own, took place either on Saturday or Sunday, on the grounds that the other people would be too back in civilian life with regard to these 2 days that they could be caught out on the hop. And I wanted to make every day, as far as the chaps are concerned, like Sunday. You took a service if you could, and if there was enough time for it. For example, when we were crossing over the Seine, the bridge over the Seine, which had been blown, and the pioneers were mending it. And the sergeant major came to me and said, "Sir, would you say a prayer for us?" And I'd got a jeep which was fitted with loudspeakers. And so I just called out to them. And I said, "I'm going to say a prayer. Give you a hand with this bridge." And I used Drake's prayer. "O Lord, when thou givest thy servants to endeavor any great matter," etc. And then I said, "We'll just say the Lord's Prayer together and then we'll get on with the job, because this bridge can't wait." And when it was over and they were back at work, the sergeant major came up and said, "Thank you, sir. I'd like you to know that there are no atheists here," which I thought was rather nice of him.
Did you actually go over at D-Day or shortly after?
I went over